Let's talk about submodalities. In submodality interventions, this is where we begin to get into our first formal change techniques in NLP. So the various interventions we're doing with submodalities at practitioner level are eliciting submodalities, contrastive analysis, mapping across, swish patterns, and phobia cure. Why would we want to learn about submodalities? We'd want to learn about submodalities because our submodalities are the finer distinctions of our main modalities, of the main visual, auditory, and kinesthetic modalities. And what these finer distinctions do is they add more ingredients, if you like. They add different qualities of ingredients, if you like, to our major modalities. So a good metaphor around this is baking a cake. If you think about baking a cake, a cake itself has within it certain ingredients for it to be the cake. So if you're making a chocolate cake, for example, then it has certain ingredients. There's a whole set of things that need to apply, and you got the quality of the ingredients, you've got the quantity of the ingredients, and the order and sequence of the ingredients. All those things we could apply to submodalities. And submodalities give meaning to our internal representations. So, what does that mean? It means how we represent something in our mind, either visually, auditorily, or kinesthetically, how we represent it to ourselves inside ourselves, the way or how we structure it in our mind, if you like, adds meaning to it. If you like, it's how we code it. It's the hidden code in the meaning. So let's give you some more examples of that. If you imagine, for example, a jukebox in your head, and the jukebox has many different memories in it, if you like, and when you get into certain states, what happens is you get access to those specific memories, because all memory is state dependent. And then what happens is that particular jukebox plays that one of those memories when you're in that state. And the memory that it plays is an internal representation, a memory of visually, auditorily, kinesthetically. And what we're really doing with submodality work is we're actually looking to see what is that track? What's the submodalities of that CD, if you like? So what are the visual qualities of that CD? What are the audio qualities of that CD? And what are the feeling qualities of that CD? As in, when you're fearful, you get access to fearful memories. When you feel strong and powerful, you get access to strong and powerful memories. And so in your vault of memories, because you've been remembering everything your whole life, basically you access those memories at those times. And we now know through NLP that we can change the way or how we represent those memories to ourselves. And when we change how we represent it to ourselves, it changes the meaning that that has. So in the same way we saw Harry Potter there, for example, and his school friends locking into what they feared, and the boggart, if you like, changed into what they feared. That's them accessing, if you like, their old memory, the thing they feared. And then when they changed the submodalities of the picture, for example, and there what they did, they was changing what was inside the picture. What we're doing slightly different, we're changing not just what's inside, but also the context of the picture. It changes its meaning. Suddenly, you know, Professor Snape with his mother's clothes on is now funny. You know, a spider, for example, with roller skates on is now funny. It doesn't have the same impact because the submodalities or the qualities of the thing itself has changed. Now, this stuff doesn't actually make sense, necessarily. It can be crazy and stupid. It doesn't matter. Life doesn't make sense anyway. It's not meant to. So let's have a look at... another way of thinking about it, actually, from a movie point of view as well, is if a movie director wants to, say, create, say, an air of tension in the film, so it's a point where they want to have tension in the film, what kind of things would that movie director do in order to create tension or elicit that state in his audience? What kind of things could they do? Music is one. So what kind of music would we expect to hear with that kind of thing? Could be a pumping music, could be like a heartbeat, could be like strings like in a violin or something. Or it could be, there's a whole multitude of different things to create that feeling. And what else? From a visual point of view, what might we see? Dark, it could be. It could be, what else? Weird angles, correct? Or slow motion can work. Could be like, you know, where someone's opening the cupboard, for example, and you know when they then close the cupboard, suddenly there's going to be a face there or something like that, and you're not quite sure. Edginess to the photography and the camera work, for example. Vulnerability, yes. So you're tapping into all these things, and what he's doing is creating this whole movie, if you like, to elicit that particular state in his audience. That's what you do in your head, isn't it? In your head, you create things in your head. You create movies in your mind, and those movies impact you. So what we're saying is, if you have movies that are disempowering, because they're movies that of past events that at the time you didn't give empowering meanings to, if we change the structure of how you represent those to yourself now, what will happen is the meaning will change, and so it will seek to have a different K, a different kinesthetic, a different feeling off of that memory, if you like. And there's a number of other things we can do, obviously, to build up. The most powerful images, the ones therefore we want to have more meaning, the goals, for example, we can create and create a better environment for those inside ourselves as well by building up the picture. And there's a number of other techniques we can do as well. And also, we need to look out for language. Now, people give their internal representations away of what they're doing inside their head when they use everyday language. So if you say to someone, for example, someone says, oh, well, he's got a really bright future. That's because what they're doing in their head. Inside their head, they create an internal representation of themselves in the future and it's being a big, bright picture, for example. That's what they're seeing. Or if someone says, like, oh, it's just like, you know, you're blowing it all out of proportion. Well, that's what they're doing in their head. They're making the picture very big, for example. Or, you know, things are just getting on top of me. Well, that's because they have the picture above them and then very small down, for example, and it's all piling on top of them. So the number of things that we do inside our head, and it gives ourselves away with our language. So let's have a look now. What are some of the things that we can do? What are some of the finer distinctions of our submodalities? So just off the top of your head now, without looking into your books, what are some of the finer distinctions? Are we talking about, say, visual submodalities first? What are some things? Size of the picture? Black and white or color? Light and dark? Near or far? Focused or defocused? 3D or flat? Yep. So there's a whole number of things. So if you think like a TV screen, you know, that's what you do. You'd adjust it, wouldn't you, with like a remote control to get it to the one that you want. And that's what you're doing inside. You're doing the same thing inside yourself. So what about like auditory? What things we've got auditory? High pitch, low pitch? Volume? Quality of the sound again, yeah. Location? Rhythm to the sound, yeah. Loads of different things with those. And kinesthetic then, what have we got with kinesthetic? Hard or soft? Yeah. Warm or cold? What temperature does it have? Yeah. Light or heavy? shape? Does it have a shape? Is there any movement in the feeling, for example? There's a whole number, again, of different finer distinctions, submodalities with those, with the major modalities. So there are, there are two different types of submodality. You've got analog submodalities and digital submodalities. Now, you won't necessarily need to know that for practitioner material, so I'm telling that in advance, but it's useful to know. So what do we think, what is the difference, forget about submodalities for a moment, what's the difference between something that's digital and analog? What's the difference between a digital watch and an analog watch? This is an analog watch, so what's the difference? An analog has no beginning and no end, it just keeps going. It's never ending, it's ongoing, if you like, yes? Whereas digital is like two things, on, off, yes? So if you think about some of the submodalities, some of them are one or another. It's like a dichotomy, one thing or another, whereas some other things are endless. See, size, what type of driver is size? It's analog, isn't it? Because size can go from infinitely small to infinitely big, yes? Whereas, what another driver would be, what about black and white or color? Again, that's a digital submodality because that's one thing or another. Okay, and they're useful for some of the master pack submodalities interventions. You'll need to know the difference between the analog ones and the digital ones. So just have that in your mind for now. So we want to use submodality work really to change. What we're doing is we're changing the internal representation that changes the state, or changes the meaning, which changes the state, which changes the behavior. And ultimately, everything we're looking to do in NLP is obviously is to alter results, change behavior. That's what NLP is driven from. So we've got two key things in submodality work. The first one of those is the elicitation of drivers. What we often find with submodality work is that one of the submodalities is the key. And when you change that one, the other ones seem to automatically change at the same time to fit it. Now, we're not going to know the driver until we actually do our mapping across. So we've got these two things. We've got contrastive analysis and mapping across. And these two things form the basis of many of the submodality interventions. So, contrastive analysis, basically, that's where we're eliciting the submodalities of two different things, often the present state, present undesired state, and obviously the desired state. And we're looking at what the difference is between those two things, because they will be represented very differently from a submodality point of view in the person's neurology. So we elicit them and then we look at the differences, because there'll be differences between how they represent them. So we have our submodality checklist and we elicit the submodalities of each one and then compare the differences. And then what we do with our mapping across is we have them change the submodalities that are not the same, change them to be the same as the desired state, for example. Yeah? That's our mapping across. So let's just try this out for a moment just to see how this works. See if we can find out, because the two things that are often drivers is, firstly, a big driver normally is location. From a visual point of view, as in where in the field of vision somebody locates a picture. And the other one oftentimes is whether the picture is associated or dissociated. What's the difference between associated and dissociated somebody? Associated when you're in the picture, seeing it through your own eyes. And so therefore dissociated is out the picture, so you're seeing yourself in the picture, the whole of your body, for example. Yes, good. So let's just try this for a moment. What I'd like you to do now is to think of somebody that you really, really, really like. Okay? Think of somebody that you like. And call that picture to mind. So as you think about that, do you have a picture? Would be what we'd say. And just pay attention now to where that picture is located in your field of vision. Now break your pattern in some way. So just shift your body around, break your pattern. And now what I'd like you to do after you've broken your pattern is now think of somebody that you don't like. Now call to mind a picture of somebody that you don't like, or somebody that you dislike or not like as much. And as you think about that person, do you have a picture? And just pay attention to where that picture is located in your field of vision. And now what I'd like you to do is to move the picture of the person that you don't like into the same position in your field of vision as the person that you like. Take the picture of the person you don't like and move it to the position of the person that you like. Okay, good. Now come back into the room. So what was your experience there? How many people experienced that their unconscious mind would not let them do it? Raise your hand if your unconscious mind would not let you move the picture. How many people put the picture into the different place and it made them feel a little bit differently about that person? And how many people had nothing happen at all? There was absolutely no shift whatsoever. So there's only two people. So as we can see, for everybody else in the room, location was a driver for those people. So as you can see, the location is often a driver. Good. So for about 95% of people, location's a driver, and if it's not, it will often be association, dissociation. Okay? Here's what I'd like you to do is I'd like you to call to mind a voice. Call to mind the voice that you use to beat yourself up with. You know that voice, don't you? The voice that you use inside your head to beat yourself up with. Just go ahead and call that to mind. And just pay attention to the qualities of that voice. The volume, the rhythm in the voice, the tonality. Speed that the voice talks at. Just call that to mind for a moment and just pay attention to where that voice is located. And where the voice kind of comes from. Is it like in front of you? Is it below you? Is it out to the left? Out to the right? Is it behind you? Just pay attention to where that is. And come back into the room. And again, break your pattern in some way. So touch your nose, fart, whatever you want to do. Anything to do to break your pattern. And now what I'm going to do is I want you to call to mind, if you will, the most sexiest voice you can possibly imagine hearing. Really, really sexy voice. Just call that to mind. And I don't mean like just mildly sexy, I mean like really sexy. That's it. And just pay attention to where that voice is located and the qualities of that voice, the rhythm that voice has, the volume of the voice. Speed that it speaks at. It's called to mind all those things. Good. And again, come back in the room, break a pattern briefly. in some way. And now what I'd like you to do, now, because there's something you say to yourself oftentimes in your head, isn't it? What do you say to yourself? Like, you know, you probably say something to yourself over and over in your head that beats you up, don't you? Yeah? So just call to mind the words that you use. And what I'd like you to do now is I'd like you to go inside and say those words to yourself, but in the sexiest voice. So using that sexy voice now. So beat yourself up with your sexiest, with the sexiest voice you possibly can. And notice what happens. Just go ahead and change where the voice is coming from. Play around with it a little bit. So maybe say the same thing to yourself, but now the voice is coming sort of down from below you, looking up at you and saying it. And notice how that feels. And then move the voice out to that sexy voice saying those words to you, and move it out so it's out like just behind your left ear. Have it say it there. Then move it out and around to the right ear and say it there. That's it. Or maybe just right behind the back of your head and say it there. And just notice what that's like. Come back in the room. That's a simple intervention like that, you know, one time now. And if you repeat that a number of times over and over again, what will happen is you won't be able to run the pattern anymore, because we just did a very simple intervention. We've just scratched the record. We've taken one of the jukeboxes out, the jukebox that says crap voice that beats me up, and we just scratched it a few times and we just put it back in again. It doesn't play the same way anymore. Now, obviously, if you go back and you keep beating yourself up and you strengthen that inside of yourself, then that will become, you'll ingrain another new CD again. But I would suggest go ahead and keep the sexy voice going, because why not? Because it works more effectively. The thing is that it's almost impossible to stop yourself from talking to yourself, ultimately. So change how you say it to yourself. And here's the other thing. Like, all we've done there is change the voice that beat you up. What if you now created an empowering voice that lifted you up? And you had that running in neurology all the time, and it had a voice that made you feel inspired. What if you had a best friend sitting over your shoulder, like a coach sitting there behind you all the time to inspire you, to hold you to a higher standard, that could give you great feelings every time, to give you a bit of a lift just when you feel you needed it most? How valuable would that be? That's already inside you. That's your unconscious mind. You just got to program it to be this rather than this. Because the truth is, there's no need for anybody out to be out there in pain, and because all they're doing is valuing pain more than they're valuing something else. So the tools to change are there. It's easy. Obviously, getting them to change and use them may be something different. And that's why we're using the 7 steps, as in, like, what do you want instead, and getting the leverage and breaking the pattern and all this kind of stuff to actually get them to make the changes.